I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind. The Four Immeasurables. Compassion.
This is class five, I believe, of Wake Up, not Wake Up to Your Life, of the Four Immeasurables. Okay. Are the microphones handy? Okay. This is the second 2 weeks you've been working on compassion. I'd like to hear about your experiences, questions, insights, challenges.
Was it your intention that we say these things out loud or to ourselves?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Whichever works. It could be done as a vocalized prayer. The main way this works is, as you repeat each line out loud or in your mind, your body's going to feel something, and you observe that and rest in that experience. It tells you either where you're open or where you're closed for that particular aspect of the immeasurable. And if you feel yourself tightening up, then you just rest in that. And when you feel it relaxing, if it does, then you repeat the line again and see what happens. In this way, you gradually open and open until you can say that line and feel it in you. Other questions?
Ken?
Yes.
My first question, I'm putting my foot in the water. With the line, may I experience the world wishing me freedom from pain? I've kind of grown up in feeling fairly naive, and when I repeat this line for myself, I feel that there's a tremendous amount of preference and prejudice, that I would like the world to be that way, but I sense that in reality the world is neutral and I'm imposing my ideal.
Okay. You've heard me talk about the world of individual experience and the world of shared experience. We grow up in a postmodern culture, or we live in a postmodern culture, which is pretty materialistic. It's also materialist. And by that, I don't mean the acquisition of property. I mean the basic belief in our culture is that the things that we see exist independently. The matter is actually there. And yet we engage in this practice, which means we have somewhere in us some spiritual yearnings. I see materialism in this way that I've just defined it, and fundamentalism, which is a phenomenon that is very widespread, you can say globally. I find both of these belief systems, because they are both belief systems, make the same mistake. And that is, they equate the world of the spirit, the world of what we actually experience, with the world of shared experience. And all kinds of problems come from that. On the rational materialist side, when you do that, you eliminate spiritual values from the functioning of the world, a spiritual sense. And that's what a lot of people in modern and postmodern societies feel. On the fundamentalist side, you seek to make the world spiritual, which, you know, like when you get into messianic cults and apocalyptic thinking and feel that you are the instrument of divine will or karma or whatever, and you just have a disaster. You know, we have a current disaster in Iran coming from exactly that confusion. Now, the reason I'm talking about this, which may feel like a bit of a digression from your point, is that you say, you know, I'm not sure the world actually would ever wish me to be free of suffering, you know. At best, it's neutral. Most of us, you know, if you're a real pessimist like me, you don't think it's neutral at all. I taught a class on karma back in the late 80s, and I asked everybody, you know, what they thought karma was. Three quarters of the class said that karma was the balancing mechanism of the universe that made the universe just. A total projection of human values on the universe. Buddhist point of view, it's far worse. The universe is not just. I mean, the deck is totally stacked against you. And, you know, you just have these self-perpetuating cycles that get you mired and mired in samsaric existence. It's a miracle if you ever get a chance even to see a way out, let alone actually take it. But that's a whole other matter. So when you say, I'm not sure that the world would actually do this, you're talking about the world out as we know it in shared experience.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's not what we're working with. What about the world that you experience? That changed things a little bit? Now, the world that we experience, go a little further here. Are there any parts of, any experiences that arise in, for you, which, you'd rather not have?
Plenty.
Yes. And it's probably not too much of a stretch to suppose that you might feel that there's a mutual antipathy there. Those experiences would be just as happy as if you weren't around either. Okay. So, with compassion, okay, there's hurt there. Whenever we're pushing something away, there's hurt. Can you be present with that hurt?
Yes. think I draw a distinction that makes sense for me between suffering, pain, and harm.
Yes, we talked about that before, right.
Yeah, so pain, physical pain is inevitable, and the body goes through its changes, and that I can accept. And harm is, again, the world of shared experiences.
Well, in the world of that you experience, I'm sure you feel that certain experiences will harm you. But do any of those experiences actually harm you? From my experience, there are definitely things that I feel would harm me. But the only reason is that I don't have the capacity of attention to experience them. You follow? Like, I harden up inside, and now we have a fight. But do those experiences actually wish me harm?
In my privileged life, I think not. But
no.
If I look at some other situations in the world...
No, we're talking about what we actually experience, not people doing things to people. I mean, there are experiences which arise, you know, fear or something like that. But the fear doesn't wish me harm. In fact, it's the other way around.
It teaches me to be present.
Well, it tells you that there's danger.
Yeah.
So I remember, and I've gone through this with a number of people. I remember going through with one of my business clients that... He kept trying to push something away and so he could just go on with his work. But I pointed out to him that that feeling that was arising was telling him something was wrong in this situation. And by pushing it away, he was actually disregarding something that was arising in his awareness that was telling him something was wrong. It was probably a good idea to pay attention to it. So from that point of view, the experiences that actually arise in terms of feelings, etc., actually don't, are wishing us well. They're telling us things about our world that we are hell-bent on ignoring.
Yeah,
you follow?
I follow.
Yeah. And I don't know whether you've ever come across it some time ago now, but John Cleese of Monty Python, Faulty Towers, did a series of recordings with his psychiatrist, a guy called Robert Skinner in England, called Families and How to Survive Them. And basically it's a very good exploration of the question, what is love? And they start off with this question, they go around the whole thing and they come back to it. And it's not deep, but it's a very, very easy, easily understood, very clear exposition of certain basic psychological principles. And the thing that makes it a lot of fun is that they use excerpts from various sitcoms to illustrate their points. And so they have these clips in there. Unfortunately, I had several copies of the tapes, but I kept lending them. Of course, I never got them back. I think you can probably get the tapes from somewhere, and it's, as I say, it's quite good. But the one of the exchanges, John Cleese says to Robert, "You seem to be saying that every feeling is important, and Robert Skinner says, "Yes, that's right." Well, anger? Well, yes. Anger tells you that a boundary has been violated. Well, what about anxiety? Have you ever driven with someone who doesn't feel any anxiety? Oh. Cruelty? And Robert's thinking, well, that's very interesting. I think of as my ability... to experience, being cruel has increased. I've actually been more helpful to my patients and clients. Because cruelty is the intentional infliction of pain. Well, he doesn't intentionally inflict pain, but when his clients are in pain, he doesn't rescue them. So they actually work through things. So, now, of course, the extremes of these can be quite harmful. But every emotion that arises is actually telling us something about our world of experience. Often we confuse that. So that when anger arises, what we think it's telling us is, that's got to be destroyed. When what it's really telling us is, you're hurting. You're really hurting. And so part of becoming present and awake is being able to know what the emotions are actually telling us, not what we project that they're saying. Okay? And this is the way of undoing, forming a relationship with this world of experience, which undoes those self-centered projections.
It would be fruitful to go back and look at why I am choosing to see the world as,
Yes, I'm going to encourage you. I'm not going to encourage you to go back and ask that question of why do I see the world this way? Because what I found, I mean, I spent a tremendous amount of time asking that kind of question. And I found, and even when I could answer it, I found the answer was useless. Because there's a difference between being able to arrive at that answer, which is essentially an intellectual or conceptual process, and actually experiencing the feeling. When you can actually experience the feeling and be awake in that experience, then you see. It doesn't come through a conceptual process. You just see what's going on. So I'm going to encourage you to put the work into experiencing the feeling rather than try to figure out why, or as I like to put it, to experience and know the feeling as opposed to understanding it. Okay?
Thank you.
Other questions? Michelle.
Apropos that question, I have trouble with the second line on being present with everything I encounter when I apply it to people I care about. Because when I'm thinking in terms of people I care about, what if they don't want to be present with what they encounter?
So when you're extending compassion to others, may they be present with whatever they encounter. Okay. Now, what happens when you're not present with what you encounter?
Anything between obliviousness and disaster?
Yes. When we're not present with what is arising in our lives, then we're reacting to it. And that, and the reaction is always based on resonance with past history. So basically we're reliving the past. It never is really attuned with the present. And because of that mismatch, projection and so forth, then problems arise and we create suffering for ourselves and others. Any different for anybody else?
Presented in that light, absolutely not.
Okay.
When I view it as, or when I experience it as imposing my will on other people, then it's huge.
Of course, but you're not imposing your will here. You're you aren't telling them to do anything. You know through your own experience that even when it's painful, it's better to be present with what you encounter than not, because it produces well, it stops suffering. It ends suffering. That is what you're wishing for others. That's your expression of your compassion. You aren't going out and saying, you know, with your whistle and gun, like, shh, you're not present. Be present or else. You're not doing that. How did you get to you're imposing your will on them? That's interesting.
When I rephrase that line to something like, may those I'm close to be present with everything they encounter, it sounds to me like I'm telling them what to do.
Well, here we have the ambiguity of English, because we have the same construction, the hortatory and the aspirational. You know.
Writer, I don't know anything about that.
No, well, they're two different moods in English. But the hortatory is, you know, may you live long. May you be upright, you know, a good puritanical thing. I think it's Amish. You know. These are not imperatives. These are not urgings. This is an expression of your heart. You know, you see someone very angry and upset when there's absolutely no need to be angry, upset, and you're saying, "May you be present with this." Okay, it's not about opposing will. How many others felt that you were trying to impose will in some way here? No? Maybe you have a messianic complex after all, Michelle.
Iconoclast.
Okay. Linnea?
I'm a little confused about the relationship between compassion, despair, and joy. Am I correct in thinking?
Yes.
Okay. So if one experiences, I guess I'm experiencing the feeling of heartbreak, and somehow I feel like that has me in a place of experiencing compassion. But if I lose the capacity to sit with that, then it kind of goes into despair.
That's right.
And then if I respond with joy,
or if you bring joy into the
joy into the picture, it broadens it. But there feels like there's some sort of contradiction or paradox in that much space. Does that make sense?
What's the contradiction? What's contradicting what?
My mind is saying that joy is contradicting compassion, but then my experience is saying that it's just sensation.
Hmm.
And it's really uncomfortable.
Are you a fan of Eeyore?
Yes.
Yeah. How much joy is there in Eeyore's life?
Not much.
No. You're familiar with Marvin the Depressed Robot?
Vaguely.
Ah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. There's no joy here. Eeyore is actually quite helpful to people. So is Marvin. But there's no joy because they're despairing. Now, if you're exposed to suffering, the suffering of others, and you don't have the capacity to actually experience it in attention, then you do tend to slide into despair. the British equivalent of the Peace Corps, VSO, Volunteer Services Overseas, worked with people that were a few years younger than the average Peace Corps volunteer. And they would send people to third world countries. So these are kids in their late teens, very early 20s. And they discontinued the program in the very difficult countries because the kids would come back after a year or 2 years there and just go into this terrible depression because they were despair because they've been exposed to so much misery and suffering. So they had to be more careful about that. Joy. And we're going to be getting to joy in the next 2 weeks' meditation. Joy counteracts despair because you take joy in just experiencing. Many years ago, I was asked to go to Colorado to participate, to be one of a couple of participants in a funeral ceremony for a woman who had died quite unexpectedly of breast cancer. And she came from a very wealthy oil family, Texan oil family. I'd met her a couple of times before, that's why her husband asked me to come out. But I'd never met the parents. And there was a couple of other people who were also doing the ceremony. And the ceremony is very much for family and very, very close friends, so it's only about 10 or 15 people at it. And there was a very good quality of presence in that. And there's a typical Buddhist ceremony, not making any bones about what has happened. Somebody has died here and going through the process. And the ceremony of purification. And it's based on Amitabha. Very nice ceremony. And we're all staying in a hotel because a lot of people had flown in from out of town. The next morning, I had breakfast with the parents, because we were staying at the same place. And as we were saying goodbye, the mother said to me, thank you very much for coming, Ken. It was a really joyful, and she just stopped right in the middle of the sentence. Because she had experienced joy, and the joy of being completely present in the sorrow and pain of losing her daughter. Now that sounds paradoxical, but because she was completely present, there was a completeness in that, a fullness, which was energizing, and it was, and some of you, maybe many of you, know that experience. So even in the midst of tragedy, there is that that fullness of being, and there's a joy in being present, because what joy is radiant presence. And it contradicts our intellectual understanding. No, this is a sad experience, so I must be sad. No, you can be completely present in it and feel all of the pain of that and be feeling joy. We have that kind of capacity. So when you bring that, and that's tremendously powerful because that allows you to be present with the suffering at a completely different level. But it doesn't compute in our rational, logical mind to think, no, I shouldn't be feeling this way. But the fact is, when you're really present, you do. And you're not doing anything wrong. And another experience I had, I was meeting with a group of colleagues, and I'd done something stupid. And they were very, very upset with me. Really upset. We spent a whole weekend sorting it out. And it was pretty painful. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. I really screwed up here. But they showed up, I showed up, and we got down to it and repaired all the relationships. It was very good. And even though it was really, really difficult, the next day when I was going to the airport, I felt completely light and clear because there had been that much presence in it. I thought, wow. And I had had to let go of any sense of self, any kind of defending of my action and things like that. So it was really a very, very deep letting go thing. And I went, oh, so this is what non-self means. You just let go of everything, and it's okay. You know, you don't hold on to anything. You don't defend. You don't do any of that. And that creates the possibility for things to work out. So, but if you go into despair, you're holding on to your feelings very, very tightly. And it's the very opposite. This makes sense? Okay. Nava.
This is about what actually happens in compassion. And so if you're near someone who's really suffering, and you get to that place that you open and open and open and open, what are you open up to? I mean...
Yeah. Okay. What are you opening up to? I'm actually doing a little more than opening. Opening is the loving-kindness part. So there's somebody in pain, for whatever reason. You know, maybe they're physically hurt, maybe they've been beaten up in their job or something like that. I mean, any kind of, maybe they lost somebody very close. Maybe they had just learned they have some terrible illness, something like that. Well, the pain and the suffering that they're experiencing both resonate with us, right?
It reminds me what I experienced.
Yeah.
That's all. I mean.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's one piece. Another piece is, when we see somebody in pain, almost at a biological level, we go, we don't want to deal with it. And also at another very deep level, we want to help them. So there's that push-pull going on in this. Right? We want to help them, we don't want to have anything to do with it. And then it resonates with maybe a whole bunch of old pains in ourselves. So suddenly, it's all very rich. So what compassion is being able to experience all of that and not believe any of it. Not believe any of it. Saying, well, you need to do this, you need to do that, we need to get out of here, and you need to do this, and this is what they needed. And in experiencing it, but not believing in it, we create the possibility of actually being able to see what is happening and seeing what is appropriate to do. Seeing what the other person actually needs. Not what we need to make ourselves, but what the other person actually needs, which may be very different. Because what the other person may actually need is just you to be there and be quiet. And that can be very, very difficult. or they may need you to do something which is very difficult for you to face doing. And that to me is what compassion is. It's being able to. One of my teachers said, synonym for compassion is fearlessness. Fearlessness. Synonym for compassion. Yeah. Because you're not going to be intimidated. You're not intimidated by the experience. And so you don't have to do something about it. You can just be in it. And it's only by being in it that you have any chance of knowing what actually needs to be done. Because if you're not in it, then you're just going to be reacting to it on the basis of your own material. Does this help?
Two things. So what is the connection? Is there a moment that this someone else's pain kind of in sync with your experience? Or I mean, you can't measure it. It's not something you can measure, but you actually don't know someone else's pain, right?
No, you don't know somebody else's pain. But you can, it is possible to be able to experience the situation without your own projections. And then you act on the basis of what arises in that seeing or that knowing.
Right. And that is the help. I mean, when you use the word help,
yeah,
helping someone, so that is the help.
Yeah. Ram Dass wrote a book many years How Can I Help? Which goes into this, because many, many instances, what you think is going to help actually doesn't. An essential component of compassion is letting go of your own ideas until you're actually responding to the situation itself. And that's what Uchiyama talks about in the parental mind, where you have this exquisite sensitivity so that the whole world is speaking to you and saying, this is what I need. So he gives the example of that professor who can't see the camellias, the flowers, that he's burning up the camellia flowers. But, you know, the camellia flowers are telling him, don't burn me, they're shriveling up and dying. And so when you have that kind of connection with everything you experience, then you respond with compassion. And it happens quite naturally. Okay. There's another question. Yes, Art.
How does one find the balance between compassion and justice?
The balance between compassion and justice. Well, that takes us into one of the things I wanted to talk about this evening. I would venture, and I have to venture it because I wrote it in the book, that justice is the social expression of compassion. So I don't see any problem with a balance there. There are two sections I wanted to touch on. Page, the adult styles of interaction to solidify and identify a worldview, on page 304, 305, with a chart on 306, and then the spiritual longings. This is where the four immeasurables come to bear on certain patterns that we relate to in life. Now, the antithesis of the way of being present end of acting. Are, you'll find on page 304, manipulation, envelopment, control, and domination. Anybody here guilty of any of these? Yeah. And those are what I call the bent aspects. But if you start with equanimity, we manipulate because we're trying to get what we want. With equanimity, we're able to let go of preferences. And that opens up the possibility of understanding. You follow? Because we're letting go of our preferences and prejudices, then there's more chance of being able to see and understand what's actually going on. That, in turn, means that is the basis for creativity. We're not coming out of prejudice. It's an open field. And as you know from your own practice of the Four Immeasurables, with equanimity, what we come to understand is that everything that every person does is because they feel at that moment that it is going to make their world better. They may be quite wrong, but at the moment that's what they're feeling. Okay. So what it does is it helps us to understand their humanity, to relate to their humanity. And when we treat people equally, we're taking a humane approach to things. That was one of the declaration of, all people have the right to, how does it go in the Constitution? All men are created equal, yeah. It's not they are equal, but they're created equal. And this equality is that's the social expression of equanimity. It's the humanity.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.